Now and again, we get a lot of books, as you know, across my desk, and we do regular interviews, at least one a week we do with authors. But just so often, we get one of these novels that you can't put down. And I have to say that a novel by Mary Rose McColl called In Falling Snow is one of those. Now, she's been a writer, well, she's been a journo, she's been a writer of books for the last 17 years or so. And this current book, whilst it's a novel, it is in fact based on real people and real facts. And it's a fascinating insight into history, particularly during World War One. And Mary Rose has joined us on the line from Brisbane this morning. Hello, welcome.
Hello, Pat. It's lovely to be with you.
Thank you so much. Now, Anna Bligh actually launched this the other night, I gather, your book.
Yes, Anna Bligh launched the book in Brisbane to a packed Avid Reader bookstore, which is her local bookstore when she lived in Brisbane. And I think that she enjoyed it as much as you did, Pat. She was most kind in her comments about the book. And it was just wonderful to have her there. She, like you, is a voracious reader.
Now, of course, you've been a journo and you're a creative writer. You actually started writing the first novel, I think, back in 1995, which was sort of 17 years ago. So what sort of journalism did you do?
Well, I started out working for the local newspaper here, the Telegraph newspaper, and did my cadetship, and I did a degree in journalism. And I have to say, I think it's a very good training for any kind of writing, but particularly for the fiction writer who tends to kind of get a bit waffly otherwise. And so now I still write occasional features for the Q Weekend magazine and for the Australian magazine, and it's great because journalism... it just demands, you know, that you be clear and succinct, whereas, you know, fiction, you can get quite sloppy. I love that mix. I just think it's a wonderful mix.
Well, of course, your very first novel, called No Safe Place, actually was a runner-up in the 1995 Vogel Literary Awards. I mean, that was in itself a great achievement.
Right. I look back at No Safe Place now, and I think what I'd say is that... I have this kind of fondness towards it, but I know how to write that book now. I think you definitely do learn a lot along the way with constructing stories and plots and characters and things like that.
Well, certainly you were runner-up in a Walkley Award and the Queensland Premier Award as well. So, I mean, you know, you've had a bit of success there in this writing business.
Yes, I have, in terms of, you know, prizes and things like that, and the three other novels have all been well reviewed. I think for me, this is my first novel in 12 years or 10 years, and I think that this is just such a compelling story, not my novel, just the story of these women that started the hospital at Royalmont. And so I think I was incredibly excited about it, and that probably comes across in the novel. Like it's just a marvellous story, really.
Indeed it is. And perhaps we should set the scene, because back in World War One, a lady called Dr. Elsie Maud Inglis formed what was known as Scottish Women's Hospitals, with the financial support of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. And she wanted to, when war broke out, she wanted to go off to the front and do her bits with nurses and female doctors and what have you. They told her, they did say, "My good lady, go home and sit still." Well, of course, she didn't. And as a result of that, she opened in World War One this wonderful hospital at the Abbaye de Roymont in France under the French Red Cross. And it's that basis, it's that story which forms the basis of your whole novel. And in fact, you've used real people as well, I noticed.
Yes, that's right. So the Scottish Women Doctors, that's right, under Elsie Inglis' leadership. And remember, you know, these were women who had done medicine in the late 19th century, who'd managed to sort of complete medical degrees and become doctors, which was very difficult. When they first started, they weren't allowed into medical school because they were women. Then they'd let them into medical school and just failed them every year. Then they let them into medical school and they let them pass their exams and they wouldn't register them. And then they registered them and they wouldn't let them do anything but family health. They wouldn't let them do surgery or anything like that. So these women had already passed through, you know, enormous kind of, faced enormous barriers professionally. And at the outbreak of war, they stayed at a number of hospitals, but the one that, interested me most was this fantastic hospital in the medieval abbey of Royaumont, which is just north of Paris. And so they were told certain things about how the abbey would be. They were under the leadership of another doctor, Frances Ivins, who ran Royaumont, and she's a character in the novel. I love her character. And they were told that the abbey was just ready for them to open the hospital. And they got there. There was no electricity. There was no heating. There were no beds. The bottom floors were covered in building materials and masonry. The German cavalry had camped in the stable buildings just a few months before when they nearly took Paris at the beginning of the war. So they faced enormous obstacles, not only the bureaucracy in England that didn't want them to start a hospital, but also the French bureaucracy, this kind of broken down abbey. And within a month, this less than two dozen women had set up a fabulous hospital that was different from other hospitals that were operating in the theatre of war. And that story to me is just extraordinary.
Yeah, there's a wonderful line in here. I love it. Because Frances Ivins is asked, will you be ready before Christmas? The 14th of December, one says, how can you be ready? You don't even have beds. Well, Iris, she says, how can we be ready? Of course we'll be ready. We're women. We do things. It's a beautiful line.
Much, Miss Ivins, as I've kind of come to understand her. I mean, when you're a fiction writer, they're real characters, and so you need to bring them to life on the page. So you've got to, at some stage, leave reality and make them work as characters. And so she's very much fictional, but I based her on what my sense of the real Frances Ivins was, which is, just this extraordinary woman who would and could do anything. I love that there's one part in the novel where they have a debate with Edinburgh. There's a very sort of stodgy committee in Edinburgh that sends them over uniforms and gets quite exercised when they don't want to wear these awful Scottish uniforms. And I love Miss Ivins, who says, if they think my doctors and I are going down to Paris in that hideous grey and tartan, they can just forget it. I just think she's gorgeous. She's just such a character.
Indeed. So what attracted you to the story in the first place, bearing in mind that you've had this on the boards for something like 10 years?
That's right. Well, in fact, I worked out the other day, and I probably shouldn't be saying this, Pat, but it was 12 years ago.
Really?
I was in the University of Queensland Library, and I was looking for a book when I was researching my second novel called What Happens When You Die, and I'd transposed two digits in a call number, so I was in the wrong aisle, as you sometimes are. And I noticed this book, Women of Royaumont, the Scottish Women's Hospital on the Western Front, and something about it appealed to me. I've got Scottish and French ancestry, so I don't know whether that was it. Anyway, for whatever reason, I picked up the book and started reading, and I just couldn't put it down. I took it out of the library and took it home and read Arlene Crofton's marvellous history about the women setting up the abbey at Royaumont. From there, I didn't have a novel. That's just it's a setting and not even a terribly well-realised setting for a novel, until you've kind of understand it a little better. From there, it certainly stuck with me. I just thought, weren't they amazing? And then sometime after that, my grandmother, my grandmother's mother, died, and she had been an incredible force in all our lives. She'd been the wife of a doctor. She'd raised four children while kind of managing his practice. It was a magical, magical grandmother, and I guess when she died, I just felt like a kind of a life had gone out of my world, and I thought, wow, she's the same age as these women who went to Royaumont. She was born in 1898. And I thought, I wonder what might have happened if her life had been different, if, say, she had gone off to Royaumont. And that's really where I got the idea for the character Iris Crane, who goes from her home in country Stanthorpe in Queensland and travels to France to find her young brother who's run off from home. Really, it was in thinking about what if my grandmother were given some of these choices that I've had in my life, certainly, you know, in my generation of women, that she never had. How would her life have been different? I guess I started thinking about. So once I had that idea, I thought, well, now there's a story that we could set here. There's a really interesting story. And so I started doing what I do, which is just writing down little doodads in notebooks for a while. Until I pulled it together in a novel.
And Royaumont, of course, is the most beautiful abbey I've ever seen. I mean, the pictures of it are absolutely fabulous.
Yes, oh, it's a beautiful place. And I have to say that I was fortunate enough. After I'd read the book, in those days, I don't think we had a doing word called Google. but I was fortunate. I looked on the internet and found Royaumont Abbey, and it's now a cultural centre for France. And so the Fondation Royaumont made an opportunity for me to go and stay there for 2 weeks. And it was just, that was 2 weeks that really cemented for me that I would set the novel there and that I would do the novel because, well, a couple of things happened. One was that, there's mostly French artists there, and I was in between, and there's not many people, it's about 50 kilometres north of Paris, not many people at Royaumont or in the surrounding area speak English, and I speak some French, and so my residency was sandwiched between French composers and French dancers and Italian jazz composers. And I don't speak very much French, but I don't speak any Italian. So I didn't have anyone to talk to. Within a few days, I'd run out of English books in English because of the ones I'd brought, I'd read. So it was this kind of silent period for me. And the place, Iris tells us that she believes it's a holy place. For me, I really experienced it as this deeply, deeply spiritual place. And I wanted to capture that in the novels because everything I read, because after I read the book, I read lots of archival material that the women wrote about their experience at Royaumont. And everything I read, it almost speaks this place that was a haven in the midst of this dreadful, dreadful chaos. So there's this beautiful abbey in the middle of this absolutely horrible, horrible thing that's happening to young men, you know, all over France. And so I really wanted to capture that in the novel, that sense of it being a safe haven, so that there's bombardment around them. They're often in danger, but they're always safe within the abbey's walls. And I certainly had that experience staying at Royaumont.
And did you find yourself being in your grandmother's shoes to a certain extent?
Well, I think a little bit, to the extent that you could. I certainly thought about her a lot when I'm writing. In fact, on my website, I've got a beautiful photo of her. It's a side profile as a young nurse. She was a nurse, like Iris is. And she was, you know, that nurses in those days wore a long veil. And she's in a veil. And it's just it's a shot of a beautiful young woman. And so I thought of her often as I was writing. I certainly felt that I was in the shoes of the women at Royaumont when I was staying at the Abbey. It was, you know, to read the history and to read the material that the women wrote. And then to be in the refectory where the Canada Ward was, you know, to be where the Elsie Inglis Ward was, to be where they received patients. I just loved that experience.
Of course, the other thing that it does, because it's historical, even though it's a novel, it brings home to you the horror of war and the injuries that young men suffered during the bombardments.
Yes, I think one of the things that... So when my grandmother died, I had this kind of a real sense of her life being quite circumscribed by her circumstances, by events of her life. There were things that she couldn't control. But as soon as you start reading any of the diaries or memoir or journals of the young men who went away to war, who went away with no idea what was going to happen to them, you realise that, of course, their lives were circumscribed too, and their lives were kind of indelibly marked by this experience, if they lived. And I had this real sense of the war as something that affected not only that generation of young men and young women, but of resounding through the generations, which is why I really wanted to start the novel further on in time, so that we could get a sense of when we have something like a war of that magnitude, its flow on effects affect the next generation and their children and our children, so that it doesn't just end with those young people, that what happened in that place and in that time has kind of resounded through history.
Mm. It's fascinating because Iris, who is your heroine, if you like, for this story, almost went to France out of a sense of guilt, in the sense that her 15-year-old brother, despite her father's protestations, had disappeared off to war, and she'd somewhat encouraged him, and I think there was a bit of guilt there.
Yes. I think that all of my novels explore this sort of... I really like someone sort of doing a small thing that when we look at it on the outside, we kind of think, well, I can understand that, and I can see where we got to that, and that it sort of somehow affects the rest of their life, and often they involve some sort of family secret, as we see here. And so I very much wanted that to be Iris's kind of challenge in life, if you like, and for her to get to the end of her life and be thinking about, am I going to let this go and forgive myself, or am I going to keep holding on? Because I think that's something, you know, that we all face at one level or another in life. And that's a theme that probably doesn't have so much to do with the war as Iris's personal kind of journey as a character. I really love old Iris, you know, when she's an old woman. I just, I love how curmudgeonly she is, you know, and I loved writing her. She was so much fun.
She's a character, there's no doubt about that. And, of course, you've interwoven into that historical story, of course, the story of her life and her kids and what have you and grandchildren and their lives and where they lead. And there's so many twists and turns, and I'm not about to give away any of the plot because it surprised the daylights out of me, I have to tell you, what I read. And I thought, what a clever lady you are.
Well, I think as I say, I kind of wanted a very physical sense in which the war lived on. I wanted a very kind of a symbol, I guess, if you like, of the, mainly because, the things in the novel that were, it's things like there's a Senegalese soldier who's 14 or 15 who's very badly injured, who dies very early in the novel. That's based on a real story. There's some things that'll be spoiler alerts that we shouldn't do here, aren't there? Boy soldiers, like Iris's brother, were very common. The youngest known British soldier was 12 years old when he enlisted and nobody stopped it. So you just can't read that sort of material and not, when I started out, I thought, well, the one thing I don't want to do is write a war novel. One, I think people have done that much better than I could, and two, my grandfather actually fought in both world wars, so I'm not sort of anti-war not from that point of view. I just thought, well, that's not something I'd feel I was competent to do. But you cannot read that material and not in some way, you know, want to present that for a reader to think about. So I wanted something that would flow through to now. And as well as that, I was kind of interested in how things have changed for women and men over a time period. You know, so that Iris's granddaughter Grace is a busy obstetrician. She's the first of the generation who are, struggling with motherhood and career, and she's trying to hold together her practice, bring up three kids, and do the things that, you know, many, many, many women are trying to do these days. And so I really wanted to present that kind of different sort of life as well, what's happened now kind of thing.
Mm. It's fascinating just talking about those boy soldiers, of course, because there were a lot of Australians who could relate to that, whose younger brothers, younger sons just took off to war because it was an adventure and something different to do.
Yes, and exactly, and that's that's the way that that's the way that it was framed. And in Britain, at least, the War Office just turned a blind eye to the young soldiers. There was one MP who was speaking out and saying it was wrong, but the recruiting sergeants would get after young boys and, you know, well, young men, and say, you're 19, you should sign up. And in fact, there's a boy in the novel, the youngest man executed for deserting in the British Army was he was 14 when he joined up. They've got his letters in the, and he wrote home for his mother to send a photo of herself so he wouldn't feel so frightened. He was injured and hospitalised and returned to the front, and then he got frightened and ran away and hid in a barn, and they shot him as a coward. And do you know, amazingly, the British Army have only, I think, in the last decade or so, included the names of those men that they shot as deserters or cowards in the list of the war dead. And I can say very proudly as an Australian that while our soldiers may have been court-martialed for cowardice or desertion, our army refused to let the British shoot them because they said they were volunteers and so they would just go home. And so no Australian soldier was shot in that way, which I think is a... that's a good thing.
Yes, apart from, of course, the Boer War, where Mr. Morant lost his life.
Yes, well, that's right. This was in World War One.
Yes, fascinating story. But just the horror on the battlefield translated into a hospital, and the day-to-day operations and the day-to-day treatment. It really brings home to you the folly of such ventures, doesn't it?
Yes, of war. But you know what I loved about that was that Royamon and the nurses and doctors there could be this kind of symbol of healing. It's sort of a very powerful symbol, so that these men would come in with their broken bodies and their uniforms in tatters because the French sort of didn't fund their soldiers properly, didn't equip them properly, and hadn't eaten. And these women would feed them, would clean their and mend their uniforms, would care for their wounds, would send them back out again, of course, which is dreadful, but would make them whole. And so there's this sense of so while the novel doesn't sort of shy away from that horror of war, it's set in a place where they were doing something positive to help people, which I really enjoyed that aspect of Royamont, that it was this healing place.
Yes, and of course the other thing they did was that they very much promoted the cause of women in many respects, and they put women in the front line, and the people of Britain, for example, knew what they were doing.
Yes, amazingly. I mean, I think the women who were at Royamont thought that everything would change because of what they'd done, that women, there'd be no sky, no glass ceiling, no limit for women straight after the war. But, of course, we all know that isn't what happened. There was an Australian doctor who served at Royamont, Elsie Dalyell, and she's in the novel. She's a very well-known pathologist. And had been a research fellow in Vienna after the war, had done some important work on the treatment of gangrene, which based on what she'd done in Royamont. She came home and really just worked in a middle level job in the public service for the rest of her life. And I think a lot of the women, this had been their experience, that the war was this opportunity where they could, stand beside men and do things. After the war, it sort of changed back. So change has been slow, particularly in a field like medicine, which, has been resistant to change on a lot of levels, not just something like this. I mean, it's one of those professions that is just notorious for that. But so, yeah, it's interesting. They were terrific women.
Oh, they were indeed. It's a fascinating insight, and also the bringing it up to the modern day and the family involvement and the problems with the family and the dark secrets and all that sort of stuff. Very, very well interwoven. I gather you edited or finished writing this in Canada.
Oh, that's right. I'm going the opposite way on the information superhero, super highway. I I did my first novel on a computer, and my last novel, it's pen and ink. So I write in notebooks and on cards. I just like the pace for fiction of a pen, and I do that for a long time till I've got lots and lots and lots of material on lots and lots and lots of things, characters, you know, ideas for scenes and things like that. But when it comes time to pull it together, I like to have a sort of a long period. So I went to the Banff Centre in Canada, which is a fantastic resource for an international resource for artists, and just worked solidly to pull the novel together into a first draft of the novel. And so the Banff Centre gave the novel in some ways its title, because where there was in falling snow. But the other aspect was, I've been to the Banff Centre before, but this time my 10-year-old son was with me, and he went to school in Banff, to Banff Elementary School, and so whereas before I'd only really been in the rarefied atmosphere of the Banff Centre, this time I became part of a little community there, because, you know, if you've got a child at school, that's invariably what happens. And it was this marvellous welcoming community. They're just lovely people. And I really wanted that experience to translate into the community of Royalmont, to have that sort of sense of camaraderie and fellow feeling. And I think that I'd say now that I tried to do that, but really, in reality, I think that was more subconscious. It was just, that was what I was experiencing. But I think the coldest day we had was -36°C, and the difference in temperature between where we were and where we'd come from was 60 degrees. So it was quite cold.
Indeed so. It's a fascinating novel, one that I couldn't put down. I really enjoyed it. It's, the combination of history and this and that and what have you. It's a lovely story. It's published by Allen & Unwin. It's called In Falling Snow, Mary Rose McColl. And I have a feeling you have a very good seller on your hands.
Oh, thank you, Pat. This has been the best interview I have ever done.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear it. I like to give justice to my interviewees and my authors, and you have to read the book to get the feeling and the sense of what it's all about. And thank you so much indeed, and we look forward to whatever you may produce in the future.
Thanks very much, Pat.
You're welcome. Mary Rose McColl joining us on the line from Brisbane.